and other businesses throughout Los Angeles. She knew what this little talk was going to be about and decided to take the initiative. "I'm sorry, sir. I should never have said senseless. I should have chosen my words more carefully." He waved away her concern. "You did good. The camera loves you." "My mother would disagree with you, but thanks." Eve started to turn away. "I've got a lot of work to do." "Hold on. You've caught the killer. That was the hard part. The pressure is off," Lansing said. "We still need to gather a lot more evidence to secure a murder conviction," he said. "You'll get it. But now every move you make is going to be under the media spotlight. Delegate the rest of the work tonight to the detectives who are outside of that glare. I want you to go home and get some rest."
"Thank you, but the arraignment is on Monday and I want—"
He interrupted her.
"You aren't hearing me. If you look tired and haggard tomorrow, after you've already caught the killer, the press is going to wonder why you are working so goddamn hard. They will think our case is weak. But if you look bright, refreshed, and relaxed the next time they see you, that projects confidence, and that's what they will feel about the case, too."
Lansing tipped his head to the press outside, many of them still on camera using the station as a backdrop for their reporting on the story.
"The press isn't following me around all the time."
"Today, everybody has a camera. You, of all people, should know that. Perception is reality, so it's up to us to create the perception," Lansing said. There was a contradiction in that last statement, but she wasn't entirely sure it was unintentional.
"I think you're going to have a bright future in this department."
"Not if this case falls apart," she thought. "Go home," Lansing said. "That's an order."
Chapter 32. Eve got a deputy to give her a ride back to her condo. She ran inside, grabbed the keys to her Subaru Outback, and drove to Barnes & Noble at the Commons in Calabasas, where she bought a large map of the San Fernando Valley. From there, she went to the Office Depot on Topanga to buy a box of colored pushpins, and then went two blocks south to Yang Chow, a Chinese restaurant across from the Topanga Mall, and bought fried rice, slippery shrimp, and chow mein to go. She took her purchases home, devoured her dinner, and got to work. Back when she was a detective in burglary, she got a lot of results using geographic profiling. The basic idea behind it is that people commit crimes close to where they live, work, and play because it's easier to find prey and make a quick escape in areas they know well. She knew that geographic profiling worked best as a technique to pinpoint the home or workplace of criminals committing serial crimes. She'd nailed several serial burglars by marking the location of each burglary on a map, drawing a radius of 3 miles around each scene, and focusing her attention on where the circles overlapped. It inevitably led her to where the crook lived or worked, or to where he'd strike next. Now she figured it would work in reverse, helping her determine where Coyle had most likely dumped the bodies. Eve only had 3 confirmed locations where Coyle committed crimes, but she knew he used his service calls as scouting trips for burglaries. So she decided to treat each service call as a possible crime scene and plot them all on a map of the San Fernando Valley. There was a crucial flaw in her approach, since Coyle was assigned his calls, he didn't choose them, but she decided to see if a pattern emerged that might suggest there were some areas he spent more time in than others and would feel more comfortable going back to for his burglaries, or to dump bags of body parts. It would be easier for the crime analysis unit to pinpoint the hot zones for her, utilizing a profiling algorithm specifically designed for geographic profiling. But she liked the tactile effort of doing it herself, and she believed that might give her a better intuitive understanding of Coyle's movements. Besides, what else did she have to do tonight? So Eve put the map of the valley up on her living room wall and marked the locations of the Mr. Plunger office, Coyle's home, Tanya's home, Vicky Denhoff's house, and Esther Sondell's house on it with a Sharpie. Then she used colored pushpins to start marking the location of every service call Coyle had made. There were hundreds, but she hoped a cluster or pattern would emerge before she had 900 pins in the map. A few hours later, she had several hundred pins on the map and was beginning to see the densest number of calls were in Calabasas, Topanga, and Malibu when her iPhone rang. She found the phone under the Mr. Plunger printouts and glanced at the screen. It was her mom calling. Her first instinct was to dismiss the call, but for reasons she would never understand, she answered it. "Hey, Mom, let me guess, you saw the press conference. It was your best performance yet." "It wasn't a performance," Eve said. "You came across as a confident, capable detective." "I like to think that's because I am," Eve said. "You were racked with self-doubt and insecurity." "No, I wasn't," Eve said, plucking cold chow mein noodles from the still-open container and eating them. "What makes you say that?" "When Kate Darrow nailed you with that senseless question, you looked away. When you're sure of yourself, you like to stare people down. Trust me, I've seen that stare enough to know." Eve was embarrassed that she had such an obvious tell, and wondered if that was what Coyle had spotted in the interrogation room. "It was the glare of the TV lights," Eve said. "They were hurting my eyes." "You don't lie enough to be good at it, honey. You've got problems with your case, but don't worry, it's not going to hurt the chances of you becoming a TV movie." "That's not something I care about." "You will if you get fired. It will be found money." "Thanks for the vote of confidence," Eve said. "You could learn a few things from Rebecca Burnside about wardrobe and makeup. Why can't you dress like her?" "Because I work on the street and she works in a courtroom, which is a lot like being on stage. The audience she plays to is the judge and jury. Doing a press conference is just an extension of that performance. She's facing potential jurors. I've got to dress for what I do. I can't chase bad guys in high heels." "I'm impressed," Jen said. "You pretend that you aren't playing to an audience, but you are. Now I get it. You've chosen to dress the way you do and to ignore your hair and makeup because you're creating a distinct character."
"I'm not creating anything. It's who I am, Mom."
"You mean you're constantly staying in character. Very sharp. I'm not sure I agree with your creative choices, but I admire what you're doing. You're more like me than you think."
"You're reading me all wrong," Eve said, but without much of a fight behind it. Her mother had made a very convincing argument. What if she was right? It was too disturbing to contemplate.
"I love you, hard nose." Jen made a kissing sound into the phone. "Get some sleep."
"I will," Eve said, but she didn't go to bed. She spent another hour putting pins in the map, and then, after accidentally sticking herself in the finger with a pushpin, she decided to take a break and approach her investigation from another angle. Eve opened up her laptop on the coffee table, logged on to Amazon, and rented the original Planet of the Apes, hoping it might give her some insights into Coyle. She sat back on the couch and watched as astronaut Charlton Heston crashed on an alien planet where apes were the superior species and humans were inferior. It was a heavy-handed allegorical tale, and although the apes were more advanced than man, they didn't have any technology and lived in earthen huts in a time period similar to the Old West. She fell asleep and dreamed of apes on horseback rampaging through the women's department of Neiman Marcus. Chapter 33. The sound of the doorbell ringing and a fist pounding on the door woke Eve up, dazed and disoriented.
"Hold on, Mom, I'm coming."
Eve got up from the couch, stretched her stiff back, and shuffled to the door. But it wasn't her mom standing outside. It was Duncan Pavone holding a box of donuts, a sight that Eve found very confusing since she'd just been talking to her mom on the phone. She looked at her hand and realized she wasn't holding a phone and hadn't been talking to anyone. The fog in her head began to clear. Her mom had been banging on the door yesterday. This was a new day, a new rude awakening.
"Sorry to make such a racket, but she didn't answer the phone."
Duncan invited himself in and gave her the once-over as she closed the door.
Isn't that what you wore yesterday?
Eve went back to the couch to look for her phone. What's the big emergency?
Coyle's lawyer called. They want to talk to us.
She found her phone on the coffee table. The phone's battery was dead. What do they want to talk about?
Maybe he wants to confess. Or maybe he still wants that selfie with you.
Duncan went to the map on the wall, which was covered with pushpins.
What is this?
All of Coyle's service calls. The X's mark Coyle's house, Tanya's house, and where he works. I'm trying to use geographical profiling to figure out where the bodies may be. It's where Coyle goes when he's not breaking into houses, raping and killing people that will be the key to finding the bodies. She pointed to the circles she'd drawn in a 3-mile radius from Tanya's house, Esther Sondell's house, and some of the other service calls. The rape in West Hills was an outlier. I think we'll find the bodies on one of these clusters of pins where the circles overlap. Most of those pushpins marking service calls were grouped in the southeastern edge of Calabasas and the Santa Monica Mountains near Topanga Canyon to the east and Las Virgenes to the west. Eve picked up her shoes and socks, sat on the arm of the couch, and put them on. Duncan looked at the map, then at the papers strewn amid the Chinese takeout boxes, and shook his head.
I've seen TV cops do this, but never a real person.
Do what?
Bring a case home and put it on their wall to illustrate their obsession. Is that where you picked this up, a TV show?
The sheriff ordered me to go home, but I still had work to do. That's all. She went to the kitchen, opened the refrigerator, and took out a can of Coke.
You caught the bad guy. You were publicly commended by the sheriff. You've already proven yourself. You can stop trying so hard to impress everybody.
Eve popped open the can, took a mouthful of Coke, swished it around, and spit it out like mouthwash. That's not what I'm doing.
Well, not right now, he said, then gestured to the wall. All of this work isn't impressive. It's kind of pathetic.
She took another swig of Coke, but this time she swallowed it. I just want to close the case. There are big holes we need to fill, or tomorrow morning Coyle could be back on the street. Duncan sighed.
I've been doing this for decades. I've solved lots of crimes. I've put away some very bad people. I'm a damn good detective, if I do say so myself.
I know you are. Eve had some more Coke and wondered where he was going with this.
But now that my career is nearly over, do you want to know what I'm most proud of? Being married for 30 years and raising 2 kids who don't hate me. I'm not an alcoholic or a prescription drug addict either. All of that makes me an exception to the rule in our profession.
She tilted her can of Coke toward the box of donuts in his hand. You eat a ton of donuts.
Because it makes me happy, he said. I make happiness a priority. That's key to achieving my stats.
Eve set her empty can on the table and gathered up her badge and gun. I can't be happy when things are unsettled. Order is what makes me happy.
You can't keep up like this, Eve. You'll burn out fast.
She pocketed her badge and holstered her gun on her belt. She was ready to go. It's just this one case.
Uh-huh, Duncan said. You aren't going to change your clothes?
Eve lifted her arms and sniffed under her armpits. I'm good. Duncan handed her the box of donuts.
I'll drive while you have breakfast.
Chapter 34. It was 8:40 on Sunday morning. The Santa Ana winds were blowing at 30 miles an hour through the Los Angeles basin, fanning the flames in Valencia, and humidity was barely measurable, prompting the 4th straight day of red flag warnings in Los Angeles, Ventura, and Santa Barbara counties. The ride to the men's central jail in downtown Los Angeles, where Coyle had been transferred on the previous night, took them nearly 90 minutes in rush hour traffic. Though rush hour was a misnomer. The traffic ordinarily didn't ebb until about lunchtime, even on a Sunday, and that was only if there were no serious accidents to clear. The Men's Central Jail was the epicenter of the ongoing scandals that were dogging the department. Now that the jail was under a media and Justice Department spotlight, every deputy and civilian employee was on their best behavior, assuming that any prisoner, lawyer, or family member entering the facility was a potential media source or FBI informant. Eve and Duncan locked up their weapons, filled out the necessary paperwork, and were led to an interview room where Coyle and his lawyer were already waiting. Coyle was relaxed, stretched out in his hard chair as if it were a comfy recliner. The lawyer stood up and introduced herself as Stella Winters. She was a short, barrel-bodied woman in her 50s, whose chin seemed to have been absorbed by her neck. A man would have compensated for his lost chin by growing a beard to establish some definition. Winters tried to use makeup to create some shadow, but it didn't work.
"Thank you for coming down, detectives," Winters said. "We won't keep you long."
"Why isn't the assistant district attorney here?" Eve asked as she sat down.
"Because Burnside is not the one with the most at stake here," Winters said.
"Say what?" Duncan said. "Your client is the one looking at the death penalty. Are there stakes higher than death?"
Winters gave him a polite smile, the kind reserved for someone you don't want to hurt who was told a bad joke.
"This case will never get that far, Detective Pavone. The only charge Mr. Coyle faces is petty theft of a digital camera, and even that charge is weak."
Eve sighed. "We can prove he butchered a woman, two children, and their dog."
"You wish you could. You found nothing at the crime scene, at his home, in his car, or on his person that ties him to those murders. The fact is, all you can prove is that my client was in that family's house twice, at their request, to fix plumbing problems. That's a shameful basis for an arrest," Winters said. "We're giving you an opportunity today to redeem yourself before it's too late."
"You've got to be kidding me," Eve said. Winters leaned across the table toward Eve, as if to confide in her.
"You are the face of this investigation, Detective Ronan. You are the one who will be pilloried and ruined when I get this case thrown out due to an appalling lack of sufficient evidence. But if you drop the charges now, there's a chance your career might survive the justified humiliation. You can blame your youth, inexperience, and overzealousness. You can blame the sheriff for exploiting your YouTube popularity as a salve for his scandals. Mr. Coyle might even be willing to publicly forgive you."
Coyle smiled and winked at Eve.
"Only if I can have that selfie with you."
Eve knew the lawyer was right about what would happen to her if the case against Coyle cratered on Monday. But Winters overestimated how important Eve's career was to her and how much she was willing to sacrifice for it. Eve was far more afraid of living with the guilt of letting a killer go free than she was about being humiliated and losing her job. She didn't deserve to have the badge if she couldn't keep Coyle in a cell.
"I have a better idea, Lionel," Eve said. "You can tell us where to find the bodies, and we'll take the death penalty off the table."
Coyle dropped his gaze to her chest.
"You have sprinkles on your shirt."
Eve looked down, and sure enough, there were some multicolored sugar sprinkles on her blouse from the donut she ate in the car. She wiped the sprinkles off, well aware that Coyle was using it as an excuse to stare at her breasts. It also meant she had his full attention, and she was going to use it. "I watched Planet of the Apes in bed last night." She added the "in bed" to tantalize him. It worked. His breath caught, and he looked her in the eye.
"Did you like it?"
"It's cheesy fun, but I don't see why you're so wild about it."
"Because it's a great movie that works on so many levels. It really says something about our society and all of the things that are wrong with it."
Eve shook her head. "It's more than that to you, Lionel. You have an ape suit in your closet." Winter spoke up.
"Nice try, detective, but my client is not going to answer any—"
Coyle interrupted her, his eyes still on Eve.
"You make it sound like having an ape suit is something crazy. It's no different than a Star Trek fan who has a Starfleet uniform."
"Who says that isn't crazy, too?"
Duncan said.
But Coyle ignored Duncan. He was only interested in what Eve had to say.
It's not just the one movie you like. It's all the sequels and spin-offs, too, Eve said. What's the attraction?
It's a world upside down. It's a place where apes, creatures that we consider inferior today, are ruling the world and keeping humans as house pets, slaves, and lab animals.
It sounds to me like you're rooting for the apes.
I am.
But aren't they the bad guys?
Winter spoke up again, directing herself to Coyle this time.
Mr. Coyle, I must insist that you... You're missing the point of the movie Death Fist, Coyle said, speaking over Winter's objection. The bad guys are whoever it is who think they are better than everybody else. This world needs to be turned upside down.
I'll have to watch the movie again, Eve said. Where's the DVD you bought at Walmart? That question made Coyle's eyelid twitch, just like it did when Eve told him yesterday that she'd tied him to Vicky Denhoff's rape. Eve found it very curious that mentioning the DVD got the same involuntary response.
Winter slapped her hand on the table. This conversation is over. We're not here to answer your questions. We're making you a face-saving offer. You should take it. The offer expires in an hour.
You heard Detective Ronan's generous offer, Duncan said. I'd take it if I were you, Lionel. Because if we find the bodies without your help...
Duncan jerked violently in his chair as if 1,000 volts were coursing through his body. Winters bolted up out of her seat in outrage.
That's enough. That was way out of line, Detective.
She's right.
Eve turned to Duncan and stood up, too. You were wrong. They don't use the electric chair anymore. It's lethal injection.
That's what lethal injection looks like.
Duncan rose to his feet and smiled at Coyle.
When they screw up the dosage and the prisoner endures intense agony, you'll see.
Eve and Duncan walked out, closed the door, and headed down the corridor to the iron security gate, which was manned by a guard. She was troubled by the encounter with Coyle. She couldn't get a sense of what he or his lawyer hoped to gain from it. Did they really think she'd drop the charges to save herself?
That was a strange meeting, Eve said.
He wants out of jail, that's all, and believes we don't have the evidence to hold him.
So why not wait until tomorrow and have the pleasure of humiliating me and the entire department in court?
She had the nagging feeling that she was missing something important.
He hates being cooped up, and the more time he gives us, the better the odds are that we'll get the evidence we need but don't have yet. They had nothing to lose by taking the shot.
Eve didn't buy it. If Stella Winters really believed we had nothing, she'd relish the opportunity to skin us alive in open court in front of the media. It would raise her public profile, bring her clients, maybe even get her a legal pundit gig on CNN. Something else is going on here.
Not everybody looks at the media angle first and how they can leverage it for personal gain.
Eve ignored the swipe at her. They reached the security gate and were buzzed through by the guard on duty. They walked down another corridor toward the next gate.
Where did Coyle find Winters? Eve asked.
He didn't. His mother did. Stella Winters represented Coyle on those jerking off in public cases when he was in high school and at Pierce College. Winters got the charges dropped in exchange for him going into counseling.
Winters must be good, Eve said. How did Coyle's mother get so lucky?
Beatrice worked as a receptionist at a law firm in Woodland Hills, and one of the lawyers there recommended Winters.
What happened to Lionel's father?
I don't know. Beatrice was a single parent, never married, Duncan said. Why did you ask Coyle about the DVD he bought at Walmart? Out of all the questions we have, that had to be the least important one.
It made his eyelid twitch. I wonder why that is.
Fatigue, dry eye, a nervous tic, who cares? You wasted an opportunity on something insignificant.
Is imitating death by electric chair an effective interrogation technique for you?
It doesn't get any answers, Duncan said, but it never fails to amuse me.
Chapter 35. Eve and Duncan walked into a squad room that was packed with detectives and deputies talking on telephones and taking notes. It reminded Eve of a telethon phone bank. Biddle and Garvey were at their side-by-side cubicles doing paperwork.
What are all these people doing here? Eve asked Duncan.
After the press conference last night, the tip lines lit up. The sheriff assigned a bunch of personnel to answer phones and more deputies to search for the bodies. The captain is having the watch commander coordinate the search, which is expanding beyond the department to volunteer groups.
We could make better use of some of those people who are answering phones, Eve said. I'd like to see them out on the street, visiting each home Coyle serviced as a plumber, and seeing if we can match more of his souvenirs to his past clients. Getting some more hits on Coyle's burglaries will help us use the geographic profile of his movements to narrow down the hot zones where the bodies might be buried.
You're the task force leader, Duncan said. You can allocate the personnel any way you want.
Okay, then let's do it. We still need to know a lot more about Coyle's life. The answer to what he did with the bodies may lie in what he's done in the past and what he likes to do when he isn't unclogging toilets or chopping up families. You and me and Crockett and Tubbs should talk to his co-workers, his neighbors, any relatives he might have. Am I missing anything?
Duncan smiled at her.
Nope.
Why are you smiling?
I like that you're confident, but not overconfident, Duncan said. Smart people are the ones who know how stupid they are.
I'm not sure that tracks or that it's a compliment, but I'll take it.
Garvey wheeled backward in his chair from his cubicle as he saw them approach.
How did it go with Monkey Boy?
It was a waste of time, Eve said, scanning all the pictures of Garvey with film, music, and sports celebrities that lined the three walls of his cubicle.
There was one taken in the Lost Hills lobby with an intoxicated A-list movie star after he was released without being charged, no thanks to Garvey's intervention.
Duncan flashed a sly grin.
I wouldn't say that.
Biddle shared a knowing look with Garvey, then looked back at Duncan.
Did you do your electric chair shtick? Hell yes, Duncan said, and the three men laughed. Then it was time well spent, Biddle said. That might have been your last chance to do it before your retirement party. He'll do it at the party, Garvey said. You'll see.
Eve was impatient. She gestured to all the people on the phones.
Are we getting anything from all the tip lines?
We've had over 200 tips since last night's episode of Death Fist and the Sheriff, Garvey said. One caller says he saw Coyle digging graves in Palmdale. Another thinks he saw him in the desert near Palm Springs. A lady is sure she sat next to him on the Universal Studios tour and that he copped a feel, Biddle added. We're feeding any tips related to possible burial spots to the watch commander who is coordinating the search parties, Garvey said. But we're keeping a file of the tips that deserve a closer look from seasoned detectives.
Show me the file, Eve said. Garvey handed her an empty file folder. Really? We've got nothing?
Nothing even remotely useful has come in from the tip lines, Garvey said.
It's almost always a waste of time and resources, Biddle said, though we usually get some good stories out of it to share at parties.
Is there any good news? Eve asked.
Coyle was the guy who attacked you on the hill, Biddle said. CSU got a DNA match off the piss they collected up there.
Yeehaw, Garvey said. We can't prove he's a murderer, but we've got him for petty theft and hitting Death Fist with a rock. Quick, schedule a press conference and break out the champagne.
It wasn't much progress, but Eve found it encouraging anyway. Any other DNA hits?
Not yet, Biddle said. At least he held out some hope, Eve thought. Her phone, which she'd recharged in Duncan's car, vibrated in her pocket to alert her to a text message. She took out the phone and checked the screen. It was a text from Nan. She read it and shared the message with her team. CSU has finished their work at the crime scene and are releasing the house to Jared Rollins, Eve said and pocketed her phone. I'm going out there. I'd like one more look at it before it goes public and gets trampled.
You think Jared will open his house up for tours?
Duncan asked. Eve vividly recalled the TV footage of reporters trooping through the Redlands condo that belonged to the husband and wife shooters behind the Inland Regional Center massacre in San Bernardino. The landlord opened the condo to a swarm of reporters and camera crews within minutes of the FBI releasing the property to him. There were still clothes hanging in the closets, food and baby formula in the refrigerator, papers scattered on desks, prescription bottles in the medicine cabinets, and dirty dishes in the sink, and all of it got pawed and photographed by the press. It's happened before, she said.
We'll dig deep into Coyle's pathetic life in the meantime, Duncan said. I'll call you if anything comes up.
Chapter 36. Eve had the house to herself. The CSU investigators had removed the cones, tape, and other evidence markers, as well as a few small sections of carpet, drywall, and bathroom tile for testing. But otherwise, the crime scene hadn't significantly changed since her last visit. The overpowering smell of cleansers and motor oil had either dissipated or she'd become noseblind to it. All she could hear was the thunderous whoosh of the dry, hot Santa Anas blowing past, and the whistling that the winds created in the chimney. She stood in the kitchen, cleared her head, and tried to imagine how the murders occurred, letting the events play out as if they were happening right in front of her. Tanya rushed past Eve into the kitchen for a quick bite before showering and changing to meet her realtor. She was in her tank top and leggings, her cheeks still rosy from the exertions of her Pilates class. Her purse was over her shoulder, and she was reaching for the box of granola bars on the counter when she sensed a movement behind her. The dog? No, it wasn't. As Tanya turned, Coyle burst into the room and slashed her across the throat with a huge combat knife, blood spraying out of her like a broken sprinkler head. She dropped to the floor, clutching her throat. Her purse slid off her shoulder and spilled open as she fell. Coyle reached down, grabbed her by an arm, and dragged her out of the kitchen, leaving a smeared swath of blood behind on the yellow linoleum. Eve stood there for a moment, surveying the blood spatter, freshly dripping down the cabinets in her imagination, and wondered again why Coyle slashed Tanya's throat rather than sexually assaulting her the way he had with Vicky Denhoff. She followed the trail of blood down the hall and peeked into the bathroom as she passed, seeing the dog's corpse in the bathtub, the white tiled shower walls only spotted with blood. The real butchery hadn't begun yet. When Eve got to the master bedroom, Coyle was straddling Tanya on the bed, stabbing her in a wild rage, ripping her and the mattress to shreds and splattering himself, the headboard, the walls, and floor with her blood. Each stab into her body, each arc of his arm lifting the knife up and down, sent drops of blood flying. Eve turned and went back down the hall, fast-forwarding by hours, and getting to the front door just as Caitlin and Troy came in from school. They were shrugging off their backpacks when Coyle, drenched in blood and now wearing dish gloves, charged at them with the bloody knife he'd been using to dismember Tanya in the bathtub. The children both screamed. Coyle pounced on Troy, stabbing him deep in the chest, killing the child instantly. Caitlin ran past him. Coyle yanked the knife from the boy and chased Caitlin down the hall. Eve followed them both. Caitlin scampered into her room, jumped onto the bed, and struggled desperately to lift the double-sashed window. But it wouldn't move. Coyle burst in, grabbed her by the upper arm, lifted her off the bed like a rag doll, and slit her throat, the blood spraying the walls and her shelf of stuffed animals. He dropped her on the floor and lumbered out of her room to continue butchering her mother in the bathtub. The image of Caitlin evaporated, and Eve was left staring at the bloodstain on the floor where the child had bled out. Something about the chain of events didn't fit. It was something she felt rather than knew. What was wrong with the scenario? Eve glanced at the bed. All the bedding was still there except for the pillowcase, which she assumed CSU took with them for evidence analysis. Her gaze strayed to the headboard and the walls beside it. She didn't see any blood spatter, which struck her as odd. She bent down and examined the sheets and comforter. There was no blood there either. How did blood get on the pillowcase, but not on anything else around it? She turned, faced the door, and began searching for any other blood drops she might have missed before. Her head was down, her attention focused on the walls and floor, and she bumped her side into the standing fan. She caught the fan before it fell and, while she was at it, examined the blades and grill to see if there was any blood on them, and noticed the power cord dangling from the back of the unit. The cord appeared to be way too short. She gathered up the cord and came up with a ragged end. The plug was gone. The cord had been cut. Eve was puzzling over that when she heard the front door open and a man's voice say, "Oh my God." She hurried out of Caitlin's room into the hall and saw Jared Rollins standing in the living room, staring wide-eyed and horrified at all the blood. His gaze settled on her. "What did he do to them?" Eve gently grasped his upper arm and tugged him toward the door. "Let's go outside, Mr. Rollins. You don't need to see this." He wrenched his arm free of her light grasp. "I lived with Tanya and her kids. They were part of my life. And you thought I could..." He struggled to find the right words, his eyes panning over the trails of blood on the floor, the streaks and splatter on the walls, before returning to her. "Slaughter them? Me?" "I'm sorry," Eve said. "It's worse than that. You actually believed I'd hack them up, splash my home in their blood and guts, and go back to a hotel in Lancaster for a good morning fuck with a set decorator? What the hell is wrong with you?" Eve didn't answer him. There was nothing she could say. His eyes filled with tears and his face was pale. "It's a slaughterhouse, and I haven't even left the living room yet. What am I going to see back there?" He gestured down the hall. "You don't want to see it, believe me," she said. "I can recommend a good crime scene cleaning service that will..." Jared cut her off. "How am I supposed to live here now? How can anyone live here now?" "I don't know." They stood there for a long moment in silence. When Jared spoke again, it was in a near whisper. "Why are you here?" "I wanted one more look to see if I missed anything," she said, which reminded her of something. "What happened to the fan?" He stared at her like she was speaking a foreign language. "What?" "The standing fan in Caitlin's room. The power cord was cut. I was wondering how it happened." Now his uncomprehending stare turned into disbelief. "You see all of this, all the blood, and that's what's bothering you? What happened to her fan? Jesus Christ, get out, just get out." She wasn't upset about what he said because he was right. Because now that she thought about the fan cord, she couldn't get it out of her mind. It didn't fit. In fact, that wasn't the only thing that was nagging at her about what she saw in Caitlin's room. She needed to focus on that and not worry about how Jared was feeling right now. Though seeing him reminded her that Tanya had been looking for a new place to live. Eve walked past him and out the front door. She continued down the front walk to her car, the wind whipping up leaves all around her. Took out her phone and texted Nan. "What did you find on Caitlin's pillowcase?" She got into the car and, while she waited for a reply, called Duncan's cell. He answered on the second ring.
Hey, Eve. What's up?
Did Biddle or Garvey ever talk to the realtor that Tanya was supposed to meet on the day she was killed?
Hang on, Duncan said.
Eve could hear phones ringing in the background and the indiscernible chatter of voices. It was like being on hold with customer support in Mumbai. He came back on a moment later.
No, they didn't. We zeroed in on Coyle before they got the chance to speak to her. But they did get her name and where she works.
Let me have them both, Eve said. She made a note of the information, thanked him, and was about to start the car when her phone vibrated to signal the arrival of a text. It was from Nan.
Her pillow didn't have a pillowcase.
There were a lot of reasons Caitlin might not have had a pillowcase on her pillow, but it still struck Eve as odd. Eve texted, "Did Coyle take the pillowcases from Tanya's bed?" Nan replied,
"Yes, he took all of the bedding, most likely because it was covered with blood, and perhaps his own DNA in the form of semen, saliva, or body hair."
That made sense. It also explained why he left Caitlin's bedding behind. There was no blood on it. But did he take Caitlin's pillowcase? And if so, why? Did he need it to carry something? If so, what? It was frustrating. The last thing Eve needed was more questions. What she wanted now were answers. Chapter 37. Parkway Realty was in an old storefront shopping center that had been remodeled to match the architectural style of the Commons and its Rolex clock tower across the street. The real estate office was tucked in a corner of the shopping center between a clothing store that sold $500 jeans and a bakery that sold $12 cupcakes, prices Eve would never pay for either item. Eve badged the petite, blonde 20-something receptionist at Parkway's front desk, asked to see Donna Stokes, and was greeted instead by Clarissa Kelton, who introduced herself as the managing realtor. Clarissa was long-limbed and long-necked, her equine physique underscored by a Ralph Lauren polo shirt and the skin-tight Ariat horse-riding breeches that she was wearing. Eve was sure that Clarissa had a crop to go with the ensemble. "How may I help you, detective?" Clarissa asked, looking down her long, narrow nose at Eve. "I'd like to talk with Donna Stokes." "Donna hasn't been in for a few days. The last time I saw her was Monday, but I'm in and out a lot myself showing houses." Clarissa turned to the receptionist. "How about you, Tess?"
"I don't go anywhere," Tess said. "I haven't seen her since Tuesday."
"Is it unusual for Donna not to visit the office for days?" Eve asked.
"Not really. Realtors aren't required to spend time in here. I have some who work almost entirely out of their cars," Clarissa said. "Donna could be out of town, or maybe she got lucky. There was one time she hooked up with a guy on Tinder, a tantric sex instructor, and she didn't come up for air for 3 days.
"It's not as fun as it sounds," Tess said. "After a few hours, it starts to feel like constipation." Clarissa regarded Tess with a raised, sharply tweezed eyebrow.
"Is that so?"
Eve asked, "Do either of you have Donna's cell phone number and home address?"
"Her numbers are on her business cards, and I have her home address."
Clarissa took out her phone to look up the address.
"In fact, I sold her the house. It's what got her interested in real estate after her divorce. She sold cosmetics before that."
Tess handed Donna's business card to Eve. Clarissa showed her screen to Eve, who made a note of the address on the back of the card. Donna lived in Greater Mulwood, one of the first Calabasas housing tracts off Mulholland Highway near the Gelson Shopping Center.
"Thank you," Eve said.
"Is Donna in some kind of trouble?" Clarissa asked.
"No, I just want to ask her some questions about one of her clients, Tanya Kenworth. Donna was helping her find a home to rent.
Would you have any of that information here, or Donna's calendar, perhaps?"
"Donna would have all that, and we don't have the password to her computer," Clarissa said.
"That's okay." Eve handed Clarissa and Tess each one of her cards.
Please have Donna call me if she checks in. Chapter 38. Donna's house was a 1960s-era tract home that had been restored to its original mid-century modern style in bold colors. Bright green with white trim and red doors. The front courtyard was surrounded by see-through cinder block walls with white decorative gravel beds at their base. The other tract homes on the street had either been drastically remodeled and stripped of their mid-century architectural details, or had been torn down and replaced with Spanish Mediterranean-style homes with red tile roofs. Eve parked in the driveway, knocked on the front door, and rang the bell, but there was no answer. The drapes were drawn on the windows, and she didn't sense any sign of life. She pushed open the mail slot on the door and peeked inside. There was no mail on the floor, so unless Donna had filed a mail hold with the post office, somebody had been home in the last few days.
"What are you doing, lady?"
asked a man behind her. Eve stood up and turned around. A balding man in his 60s, wearing an untucked safari shirt with about 37 pockets, cargo shorts with 12 more pockets, and a pair of flip-flops, stood on the sidewalk with his hands on his hips. "I'm Detective Eve Ronan." She took out her badge and flashed it as she approached him. "Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department."
"We're colleagues," he said.
"We are?"
"I'm Irv Rothstein, commander of the Greater Mulwood Neighborhood Watch Patrol. That's why I was checking up on you. I live across the street."
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder at a tract home with four obvious, poorly constructed room additions that hung on the house like the pockets on his cargo shorts. A placard in the window, shaped like a stop sign, said, "This house is protected by Neighborhood Watch."
"We watch for intruders of all kinds, including coyotes."
"It's good that you keep a close eye on your homes. I'm looking for Donna Stokes. Have you seen her around?"
"Not since Wednesday. Her dog started barking early Thursday morning, so I went in to check on him," he said. "It's not like Donna to leave Captain America in the house all day. The captain pooped all over the living room. I'm talking big piles, and there wasn't any water in his bowl."
Eve's heart rate quickened. Donna had been gone since Wednesday, the day she was supposed to meet Tanya to show her some rental homes, the same day the family was murdered. That couldn't possibly be a coincidence. The question was, what did it all mean?
"You have a key to her house?" Eve asked. "Oh, sure. And she has mine, too. We take care of each other's dogs when we go on vacations, or if something comes up that keeps us away from home for too long. We can't keep our dogs outside because of the coyotes, so they're house dogs. The problem is, we can't be away for more than 4 or 5 hours, or we're going to have a mess to clean up. We have shag carpet, and the stains never go away."
"Donna didn't call you to say she'd be away?"
"No, she didn't, and it makes no sense. She even calls if she has an unexpected amorous encounter, if you follow my meaning. Captain America has been over with Martha and me since Thursday. He's such a sweet dog. Snickerdoodle loves him. She's a French poodle."
"Did everything look okay inside Donna's house?" Eve asked.
"Besides the poop and the pee I had to clean up? Yeah, it was fine. But I'm not a fan of retro furniture. It was dated then, and it's even more dated now. Classic furniture never gets old. Always buy classic designs. I should know. I'm in the furniture business."
"Is her car in the garage?"
"Never," Irv said. "She uses the garage as a storage unit. It's wall to wall, floor to ceiling boxes of God knows what. She always parks in the driveway. That's the problem with these mid-century houses. All windows and no place to put anything."
Her car was gone, too. An idea was beginning to form in the back of Eve's mind about how this new information could factor into what happened to Tanya.
"What kind of car does she drive?" "A 2017 Mercedes E-Class, metallic blue with a fancy license plate rim covered in fake Swarovski crystals."
"Swarovski," Eve said.
"Whatever.
I think it's garish. Captain America's collar has them too, which is humiliating for a Doberman, especially one with that name, Irv said. Is Donna in trouble?
It was the same question Clarissa had asked. It's the same question most people asked whenever she started prodding them about someone. Eve didn't have a straight answer. Yes, she was sure Donna was in trouble, but what kind? No, I just want to ask her some questions about a friend of hers, Eve said, and handed Irv her card. Please ask Donna to give me a call when she gets home. He stuck the card in one of his many shirt pockets.
I'll keep my eye out for her.
Eve left the Mulwood neighborhood, turned north onto Mulholland Highway, and drove toward the Welcome to Calabasas median boulder, where 3 days ago, two LAPD detectives had tried to stick her and Duncan with a dead man in his pickup truck. His throat had been cut wide open. The body was found on the same morning that the homicides of Tanya and her children were discovered. In fact, Eve realized, the truck was parked only a few yards from the Gelson Shopping Center where the deputies gathered before serving the no-knock warrant at Coyle's house. They met there because it was the nearest rallying point for them near Coyle's house. Another odd coincidence. Or was it? Eve slammed on her brakes, coming to a jarring stop at the same spot where the LAPD cars had been parked the morning that she and Duncan had rolled up behind the dead man's truck. Her heart was racing. She knew that she was onto something, but she wasn't sure what it was. She looked across the flowerbed median at the northwest corner of Mulholland and Mulholland. There was an office building that was set back from the corner by a parking lot and a grove of pine trees. It was the spot where the pickup, its windshield splattered with blood, had been parked before the LAPD officer pushed it over the city limits into the Calabasas side of the road. It struck Eve at the time, and again now, that the man had picked a strange place to slit his throat. Did his choice have something to do with the office building, or was it the view of Gelson's? If he was murdered, by whom, and why here, of all places? She got out of her car and looked at what was on her side of the street. A cyclone fence surrounded a dense wooded patch of oaks and brittle parched brush that covered the hillside. There was a dry creek down below that she assumed weaved its way along the base of the hills to Topanga Canyon. Eve jumped up on the cyclone fence, easily scaled it, and dropped down on the hard dirt on the other side. She followed the arid creek bed east, past the fenced boundary of Louisville High School, a Roman Catholic girls' school, and then followed a deer path that cut through the weeds and brush, going up and across the steep hillside at an angle that made the ascent gradual and easy. She stopped and looked up to see what was at the top of the hill. It was Coyle's mobile home park. And high behind that, looming ominously above the Santa Monica Mountains to the southeast, was a massive, billowing cloud of roiling dark smoke. Eve knew exactly what was burning, and that it was her fault. Chapter 39. Eve sat down on the hillside, closed her eyes, and tried to clear her head. It was as if every synapse in her brain was firing at once, 1,000 firecrackers exploding, making her ears ring. The discovery that the realtor and her car were missing, and the proximity of the dead man in the truck to Coyle's mobile home, gave Eve a new, terrifying perspective on the murders. It was forcing her to rethink her assumptions, the meaning of the evidence they'd collected, and the significance of what she'd seen in her last walkthrough of the house before Jared set it ablaze. She was still trying to make sense of it all when her phone rang. It was Duncan.
There's a huge fire in Topanga.
I can see it, Eve said.
You'll never guess where it started.
It pained her, but she knew. Tanya's house. She thought about what Jared told her. How am I supposed to live here now? How can anyone live here now?
After you left, Jared soaked it in gasoline and set it on fire. He's in custody, but by the time the fire department got up there, the wind had whipped the blaze into a firestorm. The blaze is moving like a tidal wave. They've closed Topanga State Park. Our search parties have been called in, and all of our deputies have been reassigned to assist the fire department with evacuating homes and controlling traffic.
Jared was distraught when I saw him, Eve said. I should never have left him alone in the house. I should have seen this coming.
How? Are you psychic? Omniscient? People do crazy things when they are emotionally distressed. You can't be expected to predict it all, and you aren't responsible for any of it. If you start blaming yourself for every stupid thing that people do during an investigation, you'll either quit the job or become an alcoholic.
So you just shrug and move on?
Sometimes I'll shake my head instead. Or if I'm really unhinged, I might do both. Where are you?
Mulholland and Mulholland. I'm chasing a new lead.
The realtor gave you something?
You could say that, she said.
Where can I find those two lazy assholes we met here from the LAPD?
The Topanga Community Police Station was off Canoga Avenue, around the corner from the Exposed Gentlemen's Club, and boasted drought-resistant landscaping, green energy design, and a vaulted glass atrium lobby. If it wasn't for all the police vehicles in the lot, Eve could have mistaken the $36 million complex for a neighborhood library. The officer at the front desk was black, and his uniform was crisply pressed, the creases so sharp that Eve thought they could be used to slice meat. She flashed her badge as she approached.
Hello, I'm Detective Eve Ronan, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. I need to see Frank Knobb or Arnie Prescott.
The officer examined her ID for a moment, then picked up his phone, dialed a 3-digit extension, and said,
This is Officer Laughlin at the front desk. The Death Fist is here to see you.
He met her eye as he listened to the reply.
Yes, she's actually standing right here.
Will do.
He hung up the phone and handed Eve a clip-on visitor's pass.
Detective Knobb says to go on back. It's through that door, then it's the third door on your left.
Thanks, she said, and clipped the badge to her belt. The officer buzzed her through a door on the far side of the lobby. Knobb was waiting for her.